This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Nearly 50 South American migrants remain at Joint Base Cape Cod after it appears they were tricked onto a plane to Martha's Vineyard from Texas. The Bexar County Sheriff in Texas has launched a criminal investigation into how they got here. We have heard a lot about the politics, but what about the people? What does it take even to get to the U.S. border? And what would it mean to be used once you arrived? Zaneta and her brother Johnson made the journey. Zaneta, her two children, ages 10 and 15, and Johnson arrived in Boston at the beginning of September after traveling from their home in Nicaragua. We're not using their last names to protect their identity and their safety. Zaneta and Johnson spoke with us last Thursday from La Colaborativa in Chelsea, which has been helping them settle in the area. Juan Camilo Saavedra interpreted, and we started by asking Zaneta why she came to the U.S.
Por la situación de nuestro país, por mis hijos, ¿verdad? Entonces, como no había trabajo, entonces...
Because of the situation that we're living in her country, it's difficult. Also, she came here because of her children. She wanted something different for her children, and that's why she made it to the United States.
And Johnson, was it worth the long journey?
Johnson says yes, it was worth it, just to find a better life for them and their family. But it was difficult, very difficult. He suffered a lot.
May I please ask Johnson just one portion that was difficult, one thing that was hard about the trip?
In Mexico.
¿Por qué?
Porque la policía me regresaba.
In Mexico, it was the toughest, hardest part of the travel. The police was always harassing him and capturing him and discriminating him because of the color of his skin. And so dealing with that pressure and that discrimination was the hardest thing during his travel.
Zaneta, what do you want for you, for Johnson, for your children now that you're here?
Zaneta wants to work. She wants to find employment. She wants an income to be able to feed herself and her family. She wants to find a house where she can live peacefully. She wants to study, give her kids education, and Johnson added saying medical insurance to not worry about any issues with health.
Johnson, do you have family still in Nicaragua?
His sisters, two sisters.
And does he hope they'll make the journey here too?
No.
They do want to, but he says no.
So, Zaneta, the sisters want to come, but Johnson, you're saying no?
El riesgo.
He says it's he doesn't want to because it's too risky, too dangerous, and he doesn't want that for his sisters. But they are adults and he cannot control, he has no control over their decisions.
Zaneta, have you heard anything about what happened with the passengers who, the people who crossed the border and were flown from Texas to Martha's Vineyard to here in Massachusetts? They were told they were going to Boston for jobs, but no one was actually expecting them.
They're saying that it's alarming to hear those stories. They went through very difficult situations because Zaneta and her husband, they had some money, but every time they got on a bus, they took all their money away. And Johnson, in one situation with his kids, he's stripped down all the way to be naked. They didn't care that his kids were there in front of him and treated him really, really bad. And so this situation is alarming for him because he knows that maybe those people who were sent to Martha's Vineyard are going through similar, very difficult and discriminatory situations like they did. Johnson wishes that his family was here with them because this is a country of opportunity and you feel a little bit more free here.
Johnson, when that happened to you, was that in Mexico or was that here in the United States?
In Mexico, Monterrey.
And how many children do you have, Johnson? How old are they?
¿Tú tienes hijos e hijas?
No.
No, he doesn't have kids. It was his sister's kids.
It was Zaneta's kids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very sorry that happened.
Yeah.
Is there anything else, Zaneta and Johnson, that you want us to know?
Johnson is saying that it's extremely alarming what's going on at the border and how police are treating immigrants. They are taking every possession you have, taking your clothes, taking your money. And if you don't give them your stuff, they are, in his words, kidnapping you for certain hours until you give them what you have, everything you have. And then you're expected to go find a bus after they take everything from you. How is that logical and possible? That makes no sense. And so with nothing on you, you have to go through deserts, under the sun, under the rain. And so the police, they're not taking care of you. They're doing the opposite. They are hurting you and harassing you when we are already going through something very difficult. And that's what's really alarming, alarmante.
And that's before ever even getting to the United States.
Y eso pasa antes que llegas a Estados Unidos y cuando llegas a Estados Unidos. Sí. Both, before you arrive to the United States and when you arrive to the United States.
Y cuando estás en la para frontera de Estados Unidos es más peligroso.
And when you start reaching the U.S. border, things become even more dangerous and more violent.
I'd like to ask, just in follow-up, I know time is tight, but I think this is important. Johnson, were there police officers or other officers in the United States who took your money or clothes or mistreated you?
Lo que sí yo puedo decirle.
He says on the U.S. side, no. The only thing that was very difficult is just the way they treat you, how they yell at you, how they make you feel very small by telling you, why did you come? Why didn't you stay in your country? Go back to your country. That psychological harassment is what's very difficult when you are at the border. But the taking away your property and your things, that was a little bit more towards the Mexican side. That was very difficult. And with other authorities, illegal authorities that were not police.
Arizona, que le llaman por el desierto, ¿verdad? Ahí hay una linda persona que es una señora.
And Sinead, that was saying that there's a lady in Arizona who she considers almost like an angel. She's helping everybody by giving them food, giving them clothes. And she was very, very nice, like an angel, because of her generosity.
Zeneta and her brother Johnson, migrants from Nicaragua, with interpretation there from Juan Camilo Saavedra of La Colaborativa. Susan Church is an immigration attorney based in Cambridge. She's with the firm DeMessi and Church and joins us on the line now to give us more context about what the legal support priorities are now. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So we wanted to focus on these legal issues today, Susan. With this ongoing story, it seemed to be important really to situate the migrants who landed here last week in their broader experience coming to the U.S. That's part of what Zeneta and Johnson were able to do with telling us their own story. Your reaction to what you just heard?
Unfortunately, what I just heard is quite typical. One of the immigrants at the shelter right now in Bourne described a horrible situation where he was attacked in Mexico, held for ransom, his teeth were knocked out, he has a stab wound in his neck. The journey that he made was incredibly perilous and dangerous. And he thought when he arrived in the United States that he was safe, as most people unfortunately do. And yet very quickly he fell victim to this scheme by Governor DeSantis and Governor Abbott. And felt tricked and harmed yet again. It's just been an awful experience for him.
Did he receive any medical care along the way, and is he receiving medical care now?
He is definitely receiving medical care now through the state of Massachusetts, but not much else besides that.
All right, so let's talk about the larger legal picture here to start. You made reference to Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. He has claimed responsibility for this act. In the aftermath of it, Governor Abbott of Texas said he wasn't a part of it, but that he applauded what Governor DeSantis did. As you know, the sheriff of Bexar County, Texas, which is the county where the flight originated, has launched a criminal investigation now into how the migrants came to be in Massachusetts. There is a lot of legal work to be done. There's a lot yet unknown. But do you believe it's likely that a criminal act or acts occurred here?
I believe that an investigation into criminal acts certainly needs to be done. I wouldn't want to pronounce somebody guilty before, you know, conviction and trial. But certainly there is more than enough to open a criminal investigation. Number one, kidnapping. Under the federal law, kidnapping does not need to be by force or abduction or for ransom, as people commonly understand. It can be by trickery, persuading somebody to do something by deceit. Here, there was clear deceit inducing people onto the planes. The deceit included, we'll get you expedited work authorization. We'll find you housing. We'll make sure when you get there, we'll change your address. None of that was true. None of that was provided, except some was through the good-natured and wonderful hearts of the people of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, but nothing else was provided by the people who promised it.
So go.
You want me to keep going? The list is long, but so just these are my top three priorities.
Perfect.
The second priority would be something under the Racketeering Influence and Corruption Act, RICO, as it's commonly known. RICO has both civil and criminal components. Kidnapping by a criminal or political organization is actually a particular RICO claim. And then third, Massachusetts has its own Civil Rights Act statute that investigation can be brought under.
So that was actually, that leads well into my next question. And we're speaking with Susan Church, who's an immigration attorney based in Cambridge, about the legal implications of the flight from Texas to Martha's Vineyard with nearly 50 migrants from South America. There are, you know, we learn when we look at different cases over time, there's federal law, there's state law, there are different bodies who may choose to investigate and prosecute. Does Massachusetts have a stake in the legal dimension of how things unfolded? It sounds like you're saying we do.
We absolutely do. First of all, the most criminal cases are based on where the acts occurred, and the dumping of the people in Martha's Vineyard, the flight being targeted here, the people being here. Now, all the acts occurred here except for the deceit and the trickery. So certainly we have a role in that sense. Second of all, the civil rights violations occurred here, and that's purely under state law and not federal law. So, and most importantly, Massachusetts has a really strong interest in making sure that these individuals are not harmed again in the same way.
Susan, there were other transports of migrants from Texas, Arizona, to other parts of the country. Were we just not aware of legal concerns because it hadn't happened here yet in Massachusetts? Or is there something substantially different about what happened this time?
So that's a good question, and it's certainly being looked at now. I've gotten calls from around the country like, wait, what? They were tricked? And I'm not sure that that question was even being asked before. So I believe that other advocates are going back in to find out what were you promised to get you on that bus? Because most of the other transports were buses, from what I understand. And I think it is, you know, somewhat different to be on a bus that makes regular stops, you know, where you can get off and do whatever you want. And if you realize you were going the wrong way, you might have a chance to get off. It's different when you're flown in a plane. One of the examples I use is if you get in an Uber and the Uber driver, and you ask to go to New York and the Uber driver locks the doors and takes you to DC, that's kidnapping, right? It's a little different when you have options to get out on the way. But certainly those are other things that need to be investigated. I do think it's a clear difference to be on a locked plane with locked doors.
I do want to focus now on the legal implications for the migrants. So a couple of things here. First, if they were, well, what is the legal status to the extent, and everybody's different, but to the extent that you can summarize, what is the current legal status of the people on Joint Base Cape Cod?
It's difficult to summarize because people came in through different ports, it seems, or different, not ports, but locations. But I would say the vast majority are on a status we call parole. And we, as immigration lawyers, just often say parole for asylum. So people are being paroled in so that they will have the opportunity to go to court and apply for political asylum.
Which would then change their legal standing here in the United States during the time that they're here?
Yes, once they got asylum, then within a year of gaining asylum, they could apply for a green card. And Venezuela, as you know, is a brutal socialist regime. And I find it a little funny that DeSantis chose largely Venezuelan immigrants to pick on because they tend to vote Republican. And they are clearly fleeing a regime right now that is pretty terrible. And that's why we're getting so many Venezuelan migrants. We never really had this population before. There's very few I've dealt with. But in the last 3 to 4 years, I see Venezuelan cases over and over again. And that indicates to me that something completely terrible is going on there that's forcing people into this situation. No one wants to leave their country. No one wants to flee their country. I mean, you can just imagine being forced to be in this position. So when they do it at great risk and usually a great disappointment that they are brought to that occasion.
So a couple of remaining questions for you. And we're speaking with Susan Church, an immigration attorney with the firm Demessy & Church. If the migrants were victims of a crime, does it change the legal processing for them as they pursue asylum?
It absolutely does. So because victims of crimes who are immigrants often are reluctant to speak with law enforcement for obvious reasons, Congress in the early 2000s created something called the U visa, which would allow for victims of crime to apply ultimately after a very long process to apply for a green card if the law enforcement agency that they are dealing with signs a form called a certification. And we are calling on Maura Healey as Attorney General and Rachel Rollins as U.S. Attorney in Boston to open up these investigations and sign these certifications, because I think that will be the fastest way to getting DeSantis and his cronies to stop using these people as political pawns when he realizes that they're sending them in a manner that will guarantee a green card.
And Susan, before I left you go, briefly, what about those who argue that the migrants are not here legally? This is the argument. And that's where the emphasis ought to be, not on whether they were victims of a crime.
Well, the problem is that there's a system-wide issue. Do you want a country where if you are undocumented, you would be always be afraid to report to the police if you're a victim of domestic violence, if you're a victim of rape? Do you want those people who perpetrate those crimes to get away with them so long as they do it on person that's undocumented? Because it might not stay that way. So I think that this was a global system-wide solution, and it made a lot of sense, the U visa, and it was essential. I mean, even during the Trump administration, U visas were utilized by law enforcement. So I think they're essential to keeping people safe. I also think that no person is illegal, you know, and that's a cliche, but it's certainly the truth. These are wonderful human beings. They are so grateful for the love that Massachusetts has shown them. And I see people as people. I don't see them as undocumented. I don't see them as anything other than human beings who need our help.
Susan Church, thank you.
Thank you.
And it is day two of the new Orange Line service after the 30-day shutdown for maintenance and repair. We've already spoken on the show about the scope of the work, some of the costs riders had to pay in time and frustration to get to this new Orange Line service. So today, we wanted to bring you a firsthand account from one rider who reached out to tell us her story. It's a story about being trapped on a train with her mobility aid as she watched her stop come and go, only to end up 6 miles away from where she wanted to be. Jess Abramson lives in Jamaica Plain. She normally rides the Orange Line when she needs to get to work, and during the shutdown, she found that the commuter rail was a faster option than shuttle buses. But one day, her commute home turned from normal routine into a nerve-wracking ordeal.
I use a walker with wheels and a seat, and I use that as a portable seat to have with me all the time, because I have a condition called POTS that makes it so I can't stand for long. So I am able to walk without it, but I keep it with me so I can sit whenever I need to sit.
When the Orange Line is up and running and that's your regular form of commute, how easy is it to carry your walker with you and do what you need to do on the trains, getting on and off the trains, getting into stations, et cetera?
I would say it's normally pretty easy. It gets harder when something isn't working quite right. For example, sometimes only one of the two double doors on the T will open, and then one door isn't wide enough for me to walk through with the walker, so I need to sort of quickly go to another door, or if there is an elevator that's down, that makes it harder. But on a normal day, everything runs smoothly, and it works to have a walker.
You know, having to walk quickly to another door, given how packed trains often are, that even sounds really stressful, Jess.
Yeah, it definitely is a sudden moment of panic when I'm standing at a door ready to leave and only one of them opens.
So you then have this unusual experience. You normally take the Orange Line. The Orange Line is shut down for a month, and you find yourself on the commuter rail. Did you set out? Did you say, okay, they say take the commuter rail instead, I'm going to go take the commuter rail?
Yeah, I've been using the commuter rail almost exclusively during this shutdown, because I'm lucky to live at a station that is a commuter rail stop, and so it's definitely faster than the shuttle buses for me.
Okay, so then tell me what happened. You had a really upsetting commuter rail experience. Let's start. Where were you headed? What time of day was it?
It was Wednesday afternoon around 2 p.m., and I was heading home to JP, and I got on the train at South Station.
And then what happened?
So I went in one of the middle doors and sat in the accessible seating that's at the end of every car, and everything went smoothly until we got to Forest Hills, which was my stop, and none of the doors at the end of the train car that I was on were opened. And because my walker is too wide to fit down the aisle in the train, I was essentially trapped there and not able to get off the train at my stop.
Jess, were there other people in your train car who were also trying to get off?
I think there were, and there were people who were just able to walk down the aisles quickly and get to the open doors on the two ends of the train.
Like we talked about before with the Orange Line, where you would sometimes find yourself with only half a door and you had to hustle to somewhere else.
Right, yeah.
So what were you thinking in that moment? I mean, literally, you can't get off the commuter rail train.
I felt really flustered and also frustrated because I realized I was suddenly powerless. And I really wanted to get off and get home and not be taken away somewhere. I had no idea where the train was going next. And so I panicked and I tried to get other people in the train car to help me. I was hoping that maybe someone on the other end of the car would be able to flag down an employee. But I'm not sure how clearly I was communicating because I was so flustered. So what I experienced was a train car full of people looking at me and no one really doing anything.
So then what happened, Jess?
So the train pulled out of Forest Hills and I was still on it. And then I left my walker where it was and I walked over to find an employee. And I told him that I hadn't been able to get off the train. And he told me that they had only opened one door at each end of the train. So where I was in the middle, there were multiple cars that I would have had to get through in order to get to an open door. So I went back to my walker and realized that the next stop was Route 128, which is more than 6 miles away from Forest Hills. And as we were pulling into Route 128, I realized they hadn't actually solved the problem that had happened at Forest Hills. And so I quickly went back to find that employee and told him, I have a mobility aid. I need you to open this door specifically. And he got off the train and opened that door for me. And I was able to get off the train at the next stop.
But if you hadn't found that employee again, the same thing would have happened to you at Route 128 that happened to you at Forest Hills.
Yeah. And that same thing would have likely happened if I wasn't able to leave my mobility aid and walk without it, which, needless to say, many people who use mobility aids aren't able to do.
So you get off the train. Now you're 6 miles from home on a Wednesday afternoon. Now what?
So I crossed to the other side of the track. I was very upset at that point. The first thing I did was call my mom and tell her what happened and vent to her. And she recommended that I call the MBTA right away and tell them about what happened, which is what I did. And the person from customer service helped me figure out what the next train was and when it was coming and make sure that it was going to stop at Forest Hills. I did also look at whether there was some alternate route to get back to Forest Hills. And it turns out it takes about half an hour to drive between Route 128 and Forest Hills.
Were you reticent to get back on a train, given what had just happened?
I think I wanted to be able to exercise my agency in that situation, and that's why I was looking for other ways that I might get back home. But when the train came, I made sure to verify that the door that I was getting into was going to be opened, and I felt okay about being there and being able to get off.
So you get back on the train, excuse me, you go back to Forest Hills. I'm assuming you went home after that?
I did, yeah.
And, I forgive me for projecting, but I know when I've had a really upsetting experience, Over the next 24 hours, then I start to stew. I start to think about it. I run the scenario in my head, etc. How did you find yourself feeling over the next day or so?
I felt really frustrated by the whole thing. I felt angry. And I think just the experience of being so powerless in that moment and knowing that I was powerless only because of my mobility aid was really upsetting to me. And I think it also changed my relationship to the city and to my sense that I belong here and have autonomy and can get around. And that's partly why I wanted to come and tell this story, because I want to, you know, feel like I have a voice here and feel like I'm getting my autonomy back.
What do you want now? When your story is told, what do you want to see the T do?
I want to see, first and foremost, that they make sure that this doesn't happen again. I think that what went wrong in this scenario was that a door was open at South Station that shouldn't have been open because it wasn't going to be opened at all the other stops. So that's something that can be prevented. I think also that when there's a scenario like this one, where there's a sudden change, like the Orange Line being shut down, that it affects different communities of people differently. And disabled people, we tend to be experts at navigating our environments because often those environments weren't designed with us in mind. And so we figure out how to get by. We do the advocating for ourselves that we need to do. And then when something like this happens and there's a change to our day-to-day lives, that will often affect us in bigger ways and in more negative ways. And so it takes a lot of forethought and specific planning to make sure that the new scenario is going to be accessible for us. And I think that there wasn't quite enough of that before the shutdown.
You said that this experience affected really your sense of your relationship with the city. What will it take for you to feel good about and confident in and like you're in a great relationship with your city again?
I think part of it will be feeling confident that the MBTA learned from what happened and will prevent it from happening to other people. I also think part of what was disheartening was the fact that I tried to get help from the strangers in the train car and people didn't respond. And I think that that was largely the bystander effect and the fact that there were so many people who could have helped me. No one specifically volunteered. Maybe it'll take a few experiences of people stepping up and helping me out for me to be reminded that there's also a lot of that that happens here.
If you don't mind, teach people how they could have stepped up better for you. What do you wish somebody in that train car had done in the moment?
I wish someone had asked me what I needed, because I'm not sure I was being totally clear about that, and then been willing to do what I couldn't do, which was just run off and find an employee. And in that case, I think they would have been able to open the door for me.
That was Jess Abramson, a data analyst who lives in Jamaica Plain. She joined us to talk about her disturbing experience riding the commuter rail during the Orange Line shutdown. Community artist Lily Shea finds inspiration in Boston's Chinatown.
A lot of my art is about trying to make space for communities to have the audacity to dream about their own neighborhoods.
WBUR's Andrea Shea, no relation, met with the artist to learn more about her work.
Lily Shea, spelled X-I-E, lives in Jamaica Plain, but she loves coming to Chinatown.
We're sitting here in Mary Suhu Park. There's lots of elders here playing cards, talking trash, gossiping, hanging out.
It's vibrant, but also really loud.
Chinatown, like many communities of color, has a highway running through it that contributes pollution, noise that we're hearing right now.
When Interstate 93 and the Mass Pike were built in the 1950s and 60s, they displaced 20% of the people who lived here. The long-term impacts have driven Shea to create public spatial justice projects.
So spatial justice in Chinatown means how can we get access to more affordable housing, more open space, but it also means at the end of the day, how can working class immigrant residents who are the most generally marginalized, have the life that they want in whatever way that means for them.
For the 2021 multimedia installation called Washing, Shay recorded interviews with residents about their hopes and struggles. One person raised questions about the Big Dig.
And she was like, why did they move the highway underground everywhere except for Chinatown?
中间局限都可以去到地下去了，为什么这个不行呢？
Shay and a team of artists combined those recordings with images and projected them in a series of outdoor installations to amplify the community's voices.
You know, we're sort of bringing people back into the sonic landscape who are usually ignored, not invited, and sometimes even erased. I really want to just make space for Chinatown residents to tell their own stories. I think artwork is one of those rare instances where regular people can really help shape something that comes to life that they can see and touch after.
Now the 27-year-old looks forward to more collaborations with the community as a current artist in residence at the Boston Planning and Development Agency.
WBUR's Andrea Shay there. Her story is part of our week-long series, The Makers, highlighting local artists of color. Today on WBUR's All Things Considered, we'll meet drag artist Lily Rose Valore. And to see photos and videos of all the artists we've featured, you can visit our website at WBUR.org. Tanisha Sullivan and Chris Dempsey are here with us in Studio 2. They ran for Secretary of State and Auditor and turned two races that might have been sleepy into real barn burners. They both lost their primary bids, and we invited them to come reflect with us now about what they've learned. Tanisha Sullivan, President of the Boston branch of the NAACP, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Chris Dempsey, transportation activist and former head of No Boston Olympics. Welcome back to you, too.
Great to be back.
So how are you both? Tanisha, how are you?
I'm great. You know, just the past couple of weeks have been, I would say, nothing short of encouraging. You know, just really having the time to reflect on, I mean, for me, it was 8 months. I know for Chris, it was a lot longer than that. But, you know, reflecting on the last 8 months and really, I think, taking the time to think about what I learned on the trail from the people of Massachusetts. You know, this deep belief in the American democracy, the understanding that we have collectively that it is under attack, and a desire to do something about it, and really wanting to affirm that here in Massachusetts, we are, I believe, ready to do our part locally and nationally to make sure that our democracy survives this very tumultuous time.
Chris, how about you? How are you? And do the stakes feel as high to you even now as Tanisha's laying out?
Yeah, well, let's be clear. Losing is no fun. And you're running about 100 miles an hour, and it feels like you're running into a brick wall on election day. And it's not fun to wake up the next day and to not have succeeded. But I am filled with immense gratitude for the opportunity, the privilege that I had to run statewide, and for the people that rallied around our cause. I mean, I'm going to start with my wife, Anna, who was incredible over our 15-month journey. We were engaged and married in that 15 months, so we had a life journey ourselves
that is
in that
commitment.
Time. The best endorsement anyone could ask for. My family and extended family, and you know, 2,400 people who wrote individual contributions to the campaign over the course of those 15 months, by far the most in the race. Many people that I've known for years, and many people that I had never met before, but decided to make a contribution because they were encouraged by the vision that we were putting forward, not just for the auditor's office, but for what the future of the Commonwealth mm-hmm. could be. So I am forever changed by that, Tishiana. I will never be the same person having gone through that experience. I know that I'm a better person because of it, and I'm filled with gratitude to all the people who made that experience possible.
Did it change you too, Tanisha?
Oh, absolutely. You cannot go through the experience of running a statewide campaign. Well, let me say this. It's very difficult to go through the experience of running a statewide campaign and not be transformed in the process. I mean, if you're doing it right.
Yep.
Because what that means is you spend every day in community with your neighbors, deeply listening, right? And really trying to understand, listening to understand what their hopes are, what their fears are, you know, what their belief is. And, at least, you know, for me, you know, it's hard not to internalize that. And to be, you know, I've spent the vast majority of my career, like, in spaces, you know, in the life sciences space, really looking at really tough, complex problems and trying to figure out how to solve them. It's really hard to be deeply engaged in campaigning at the statewide level, in community with people, hearing, being a part of these conversations and not want to work to solve some of the problems and the challenges that people are lifting. And so, yes, it's a transformative experience. To Chris's point, I mean, I definitely see it as a privilege to be able to do this. I'm very grateful that I, you know, that I had the support to be able to do it. And, you know, I think one of the things someone said to me early on, before I even, you know, announced publicly, and I will never forget it, they said, you know, you're not prepared to win until you're ready to lose, right? And right, because what that means is, like, if you're prepared to win and to lose, then you're willing, then you put your all out there. You give it your all. And so I know that we gave it our all. I really and I'm really proud of that. And you know, and look forward to, you know, continuing to do this work.
We're talking with Tanisha Sullivan, who was a Democratic candidate for Secretary of State, and Chris Dempsey, a Democratic candidate for auditor before the primaries. Chris, you nodded pretty vigorously several times there with Tanisha, but especially the idea that you're not really ready to win until you're ready to lose. So let me just let you pick up on that thread. Take it where you want to go.
Well, sometimes in these conversations after the campaign, people will ask, you know, do you have any regrets or do you regret running? And the answer is an unequivocal no. I would regret having not run. I'm, again, so privileged to have had the chance to do it. And that's just very clear to me. Like Tanisha, I'm someone that believes in a very bright future for this Commonwealth. We have a lot of things that make this state exceptional. We also have lots of things that we need to fix and we need to get better at, places where we've fallen behind, where we should be a national leader. In Tanisha's case, she raised issues around voting access and the wide gap that we see across race, across income, and people's ability to vote and their the information that's put in front of them, the access they have to that information. In my case, we talked about issues like climate change and making the auditor's office the first in the country to incorporate carbon accounting into our audits of state agencies. We looked at things like tackling reform of the Massachusetts State Police. There's broad agreement that that agency needs more oversight and reform. So we were able to highlight things that need to be fixed. I know Tanisha pretty well at this point. I know that she is not going away on any of these issues. In fact, she's now only better prepared to be an advocate and effective at making that change, having gone through that experience. I feel the same way in terms of my ability to have an impact on the Commonwealth, having gone through the last 15 months.
So, well, go ahead, Tanisha.
Well, one of the things I was going to say, I think a key takeaway for me, and Chris, we've talked about this, is, you know, and it's something that we, I think we need to do collectively, is do a better job at helping all of us understand how our government works and what these roles do. Because the fact of the matter is, whether we're talking about the state auditor role or the Secretary of State role, these are critically important executive offices that by design are really meant to help people across the Commonwealth, in some respects, most directly, right? And so as I was out there, you know, and I know it was the case with the auditors, people were like, what does the Secretary of State do? We get to vote on that? And they were same for auditor. They were, what is that? You know, and so really helping people understand these roles that, you know, as you described at the top, Tiziana, you know, somewhat sleepy. They, not only are they not sleepy, we can't afford for them to be sleepy. And we need more people to understand the roles and how these roles can function.
So how do we do that, Chris?
We've got a lot of work to do, I think, especially in these down ballot races. I was looking at some of the polling data, and Massing Polling Group, which used to be a close partner to WBUR, one of the most respected polling agencies in the state, found that the day before the election, 45% of people in the state auditor's race still hadn't made up their mind. 71% of voters in mid-August said that they did not have enough information on this race. And I'm sure the numbers were similar for Tanisha's race. I want to credit WBUR here. Tiziana, as you know, you hosted the first debate, very informative, intense debate, but I think one that showed some real contrast between the candidates. WBR, unfortunately, was one of the few outlets to also just cover the race and write a story about it. Simone Rios did a great piece on it. Here was the title of that piece, though. The headline, State Auditor Candidates Vie for Voters' Attention in Often Overlooked Race. So it almost reinforced the idea that this is something that people aren't paying attention to. I wish every media outlet had had the same ability and resources to invest in the state auditor's race that WBR was able to, because I think we would have had more information in front of voters and more ability for folks to say that they were making an informed choice. What we saw, based on just our website hits alone, most days in August, we'd get between, 800 and 2,000 website hits. We got 6,000 on election day. And that's literally people in the voting booth pulling out their smartphone and saying, I got to figure this race out in real time and making a snap decision. And there's nothing against people doing that. That's, you know, that's their right. But it's unfortunate that that's the case.
So how does it make the two of you feel? So one of the things that I think about is you put yourselves out there and put yourselves out there in a way most people will never make themselves vulnerable, will never raise their hands to serve in this way, will never have to be as transparent and open. And Tanisha, as you say, constantly listening, constantly present. I feel a little protective of you to find out that you put all of that out there. And Chris, you know, for example, says that not long before the race, the election day people are like, I don't know.
Fewer than 20% of voters knew who I was on election day. Now, the same is true for my opponent, right? So it's not like there was some mismatch there, but a lot of voters were making up their mind at the last minute. And that's frustrating.
I mean, my case was a little different, right? Because my opponent had, had been in office for 28 years. So people knew and know who he is, right? But I do think this piece, I want to pick up on this thread that Chris is raising around the role of media. I think, with the just big picture, the conversation around our democracy is often centered on government and the people. I think rightfully so. But I also think we've got to ensure that we're pulling media into that conversation as well, as the fourth estate. Media has such an important role to play in ensuring that we have a strong democracy, an informed democracy. And so really thinking about, and in some respects, I recognize this means that the media has to show, hold a mirror up to itself during such a tumultuous time. But I do think, as we are in this ecosystem now and folks are trying to figure out how we not just protect what we have, but expand what we have, the role of media is so critically important. And to Chris's point, so few media outlets did the work of helping to educate, not even taking positions on candidates, but just educate the electorate around these offices writ large. And they have such an important role to play in the type of democracy that I know so many of us are hoping for.
We're talking with Tanisha Sullivan and Chris Dempsey here about the primary race just passed in September. So a couple of threads I want to pick up on from that. One, it makes me think, Tanisha and Chris, I said in the beginning, barn burners, right? These races became barn. They won't always be. And it sounds, Chris, like what you're saying in part is, regardless of how tense or tight a race might be, we need to hammer away at the importance of these statewide offices and keep them front and center for the good of the democracy.
I think that's right. And I would also emphasize local offices, too. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of our media is so focused on these national races. There's probably as much coverage about John Fetterman versus Dr. Oz as there is about the state auditor race here in Massachusetts. And we don't have any say over
that's Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania for Senate,
just to
right?
Make sure yes. Sorry, there's no.
Yes. But probably many of your listeners know those names versus Dempsey DeSaglio or Sullivan Galvin, right? Yeah. So we have real ability to change the outcomes of those races with more engagement at the local level as well. I've been a Brookline town meeting member for a decade. The turnout for those races is still very low compared to national elections. even though those are the elections that determine, you know, what potholes get fixed and what the state of our public parks are going to be. Whereas, you know, frankly, in a national presidential election, your vote for Biden versus Trump doesn't make that much of a difference in Massachusetts. So we need to remind citizens and voters that it is these local and state races that have an impact, that lead to the next generation of leaders in Massachusetts. And if we want Massachusetts to continue to be an exceptional place, we have to focus more on those races.
So, Tanisha, that makes me think of the other piece I wanted to ask about. So we did a leadership series reflecting on leadership. How do you step up? We had a conversation with former Newton Mayor Seti Warren, who ran for governor and senator. And one of the things that he lamented was the nationalization of our local politics, that it used to be that local politics was where you talked, as Chris said, about potholes, right? You talk about the voting booths in your community. Are we overly nationalizing the issues with our focus, let's say, on immigration right now? Anthony Brooks just did a story on this morning after the migrants came to Martha's Vineyard last week. Are we nationalizing our local politics to detriment?
I think it's important for us to continue to have an understanding and do our part in the national ecosystem. But one of the things that I was struck by while on the trail was the deep desire of people to engage locally, but their uncertainty of how. And it was almost easier for them to, you know, participate in a postcard drive for Pennsylvania or for Georgia or North Carolina than it was for them to understand what they could do in their own backyard. And so I think we have the desire here in Massachusetts to be engaged, but it's almost like the national landscape is almost easier. It's almost easier for people to plug into than here at the local level. And that's something that I think we can easily address. But we've got to, you know, one of the other things, you know, I think is important. You got to know that you've got a little problem, a little challenge to solve and before you can actually find a solution. And so we'll work toward that.
So in a word, because we've got about 10 seconds left, do you think either of you will run again?
I'd look for other ways to serve.
And Tanisha?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very fortunate to already be engaged in service, you know, NAACP and other boards that I serve on. So I look forward to continuing to do that type of work.
All right. Tanisha Sullivan, former candidate for Secretary of State, president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, and Chris Dempsey, former Democratic candidate for state auditor, also former Assistant Secretary of Transportation for Massachusetts in the Deval Patrick administration. It takes a lot to come share lessons. I appreciate you reflecting. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.